Welcome to The Nature of Florida, the Sunshine State's only podcast dedicated to its wild and natural places and the fight to preserve them. I'm your host, Oscar Corral, a two-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and journalist. I've dedicated much of my career to making films about environmental issues. Tune in each week to hear from a broad range of voices, from scientists to surfers, activists to mermaids, who are working on the front lines to save what's left of Florida's natural beauty and its wildlife.
Hello, fellow Florida nature lovers, and welcome to the Nature of Florida podcast. I'm honored and privileged to welcome veteran environmental journalist Curtis Morgan. Curtis has been an editor with the Miami Herald for many years, expertly covering the local, statewide, and even national issues impacting Florida's environment. And you'll be hard-pressed to find someone more knowledgeable to preserve our state's natural flora and fauna, and committed to educating and inspiring our residents to support this important cause. So thanks, Curtis, for joining us, and welcome to the podcast. I'm gonna get started right away. I wanna know, Curtis, what's the best fishing spot in Miami?
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here, first off, and I like the title, Nature of Florida. That's gonna work. I'm glad you might wanna trademark that. The best fishing spot in Miami. It depends on what you wanna do, man. I tend to do shallow water flats fishing. So there's a lot of beautiful grass flats that are still healthy on the fringes of Biscayne Bay. I know there's a place out there that a lot of people know, Soldier Key, is surrounded by very large and healthy grass flats. And that's where I would tend to find bonefish, which is something that I pursue. I will tell you that I used to see them a lot, even though I'm not an expert at catching them, and I catch them occasionally, but now I don't see them so much anymore. So that's a question that a lot of people have, is have the bonefish disappeared, et cetera. There's a lot of questions about the freeze and migratory patterns and climate change, but I like any of the grass flats at Biscayne Bay are where you'll find me.
Biscayne Bay has been going through some changes over the past 20 years, and you being out there often have probably seen this with your own eyes. Tell me about some of the changes you've seen out in Biscayne Bay over the last 20 or 25 years.
Oh my goodness, 20 years. I could go back some of my earliest childhood memories. This is, you know, unfortunately more than 50 years ago, our fishing in Sands Cut with my father in a crappy old boat. And there used to be healthy corals near shore. Actually, on the outside of the Elliott Key in those islands, a lot of those corals have died. The grass flats have disappeared. You've probably seen drone footage of many of the flats have been crisscrossed with prop marks because of the vast influx of boaters. So, I mean, it's had profound changes. More recently, what has happened, and particularly in the last couple of years, as we've seen more seagrass die-offs, algae blooms, and in the northern part of the bay, this would be, north of Government Cut, and there's been what some of the scientists call a regime change, which means some of the shoal grass and turtle grass beds that used to dominate the shallow water areas there are gone, and they've turned to other forms of algae that grow on the bottom and things like that. There is a lot of thought that has to do with just the nutrient load, pollution pouring in from the canals. And the Herald is Alex Harris and Adriana Brasilero, our environmental reporters, have done a couple of very lengthy stories of late on the impacts of septic tanks on the bay. I mean, they've been around here for decades. They were 50 years ago, the EPA warned that septic tanks were a huge problem for the bay. We've done nothing about it. There's still 125,000 of them. And so now there's talk to do stuff about it, but it's sort of a mix of influences that has impacted the bay.
So 50 years ago, the EPA warned that septic tanks were a problem in the bay, and very little has been done. Has the state acknowledged that septic tanks are a problem in the bay? And is there any sort of plan to try to reduce the amount of septic tanks in Miami-Dade County and maybe switch them to central sewer or something like that?
Yeah, there's been a variety, every 10 or 20 years, there's some report. What the state's position is on it at the moment, I'm not exactly sure. It had been a kind of an EPA study. I'm sure the state's looked at it. I think most of the environmental understand that they're a big part of the nutrient load, but replacing these things is incredibly expensive. You have to run sewer lines through old established neighborhoods and things like that. I think the latest estimate to get rid of the vast majority of Miami-Dade's septic tanks is $4 billion. $4 billion. Most recently, we made a big hullabaloo because the state pledged $20 million to Biscayne Bay cleanup, and the county, I think, threw in 10. So that's $30 million on a $4 billion cost. But they are beginning to talk about picking some of the low-hanging fruits, some of the septic systems that are most obviously failing and nearer to the bay. I think they're first on the agenda, but I don't know if anybody has made any, you know, decisions to actually start doing it. There's a high cost to homeowners. Most of these, you know, these can cost $10,000 to $20,000 for a homeowner to replace. So there's some sort of talk of maybe some sort of shared funding from local and state government, maybe even federal government, that would help offset those costs. But it's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Isn't Miami also one of the only communities in the United States that still sends their sewage, partially treated sewage, and dumps it out in the ocean just a couple miles from our famous beaches? Isn't that happening?
Yes. I think, I'm not sure if Broward phased it out. I think Palm Beach has, but this used to be the method in Southeast Florida, not so much in Southwest, but in Southeast Florida, all the way up to Brevard County, you would run a sewer pipe out about a mile and a half and dump partially treated sewage. And about a decade ago, the state decided that that was not a good practice. There was some evidence that it was doing damage to reefs with algae collections and stuff like that. The original idea was, there's an old saying in sewage management, that the solution to pollution is dilution. Have you ever heard that? So basically, when you if you dilute sewage or pollution, the effects minimalize. So the idea was that we could pump millions of gallons of sewage out into the Gulf Stream, and it would pick up and move around and be diluted and not have much impact. But what they observed was that over time, it was damaging the reefs. I will tell you that for decades, some of those outfall areas where they would bubble up would attract a lot of bait fish and a lot of mackerel, and they were popular fishing areas for some people. So the state mandated that all these counties do away with that by, I believe, 2025. That's what, 4 years from now. So the county has been looking for ways to utilize, I think it's like 100 or 125 million gallons a day of sewage. And the most recent one is they are reaching an agreement with Florida Power and Light to use treated wastewater to help resolve some of the cooling canal and cooling issues at Turkey Point. Those have malfunctioned to some degree.
Why is that important? Does Turkey Point use a lot of water that they pump from the aquifer? Why would Turkey Point need to use recycled wastewater?
Turkey Point has it's a unique nuclear power plant. I think it was built in the 60s, but went online in the 70s, and it has a vast network of cooling canals. If you can actually see it from satellites, it's pretty amazing. It looks like a giant radiator down there in South Dade. And so that the idea was that those cooling canals, the water would basically circulate through, and they would use it to cool the nuclear power plant, the generators there. Over time, those canals have become hypersaline, super salty. And because they're built in limestone, porous limestone, they've also leaked out to surrounding areas. They've leaked into surrounding groundwater and potentially could threaten drinking water well fields to the west. And they've also leaked into Biscayne Bay to some degree. And more recently, the utility has struggled with higher water temperatures in the canals and algae blooms, which have kind of limited their effectiveness for cooling a nuclear reactor. So as part of the plan to resolve this, they need more fresh water to go into those canals. And so that's where the sewage comes in. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to happen is initially the plan was to put that treated sewage into the canals, but there was a concern it would leak out into the bay. Now they're going to basically use the treated sewage to cool some gas-fired power plants and take the water they were using there and put it in the canal. So it's all basically to resolve cooling problems there. Part of the Everglades restoration plan initially was to send more fresh water to Biscayne Bay. It used to be more of a estuary environment. There used to be oysters down there. Now it's almost as salty, probably saltier than the ocean. So there also is interest in getting more fresh water into the wetlands in South Biscayne Bay. And there's some environmentalists and some groups that are pushing to expand that new sewage plant to maybe treat water and put it out into the bay.
Everglades restoration has a loose connection to Biscayne Bay in terms of water flow. So I guess when they drained South Florida, 100 years ago or whatever, they didn't take into account the fact that a lot of that fresh water ended up in Biscayne Bay.
It did.
Tell me about that.
You may have heard, if you drive across Tamiami Trail or Alligator Alley, you're driving over an area called the Shark River Slough, which was, water used to come down from Lake Okeechobee, go through the central Everglades and go down through Shark River Slough into Florida Bay. And so when the lake got too high, all that water would spill down. And that's why they call it the River of Grass. The water flows through the grass. But there were also sloughs, lesser known, that would break off and go towards southern Biscayne Bay and even the Miami River. You know about the Miami Rapids? Seen the Miami Rapids? There's a trailer park there now over what used to be the Miami Rapids.
So Miami Rapids.
They were called the Miami Rapids, but they really weren't, giant rapids. But there was an area where the water would flow out of the glades historically and over these little rapids and work their way to the bay. So there used to be part of the flow of the Everglades would come off into Florida Bay, into Barnes Sound, which is between Biscayne Bay and Florida Bay, and make its way over there. And that's all been cut off by development decades ago. So part of the plan, and I think it was kind of a minor part of the Everglades restoration plan, was to somehow also revive flows to Biscayne Bay. That has been heavy lifting. There's a lot of competing interests. If you pour more water down there, the farmers are concerned it will rot their roots of avocado trees. And there's been a lot of political and scientific debate about just how to do that. So the idea that you could take treated wastewater and use it is appealing. The problem with treated wastewater is when we flush our toilets and urinate and do other sort of bodily functions, we also release stuff that's in our system, like pharmaceuticals, birth control pills that aren't totally absorbed. And there's been some studies that suggest those things don't get cleaned out in most sewage treatment plants, and they can affect the marine life.
And do those things end up in our drinking water? Do they come back to us somehow?
I don't know about the drinking water. I think it's more just the sewage water. I think the drinking water is more impacted by rock mining and sewage spills or oil spills and things like that happen in industrial areas.
So going back to the bay, you tell me about your experience growing up in Biscayne Bay and how you got into fishing. You mentioned earlier you're going out in an old boat with your dad. Tell me about your early experiences with Biscayne Bay and what time period we're talking about.
We're talking about the 1960s and 70s. My family was here in the late 50s. I was technically born in Delray, but I think we moved down to South Dade when I was like 6 months or so. So I consider myself a Miami native. In the Coral Reef area near Deering Estate, you know where that is?
Yes.
You know where Deering Estate is. You've been to Deering Estate,
yes.
Oscar, haven't you? Okay. So, it's the bay was right there. You could ride your bicycle to it. And my father just liked the outdoors. So we got an old boat and that was part of our lifestyle. We spent a lot of weekends on Biscayne Bay. My folks bought a place in the Keys, a little undeveloped strip of land, and he stuck a trailer on there. And we didn't have the money to build a house, but so he would pull a construction permit every like 6 months, which allowed you to keep the trailer there. Never did any construction, but we had a little trailer. So it was just part of our lifestyle. And then my dad died when I was pretty young, and my mom would continue to allow me to use this little boat that we had, a little whaler-like boat. And I don't know, she'd probably be arrested now, but back then you just take a 13 or 14-year-old boy down to the boat ramp, let him go for the day, and then come back and get him later. So it was a lot of fun. So we did a lot of diving and fishing and stuff like that. So I have a real affection for the place.
So you were out on Biscayne Bay alone on a boat when you were 13 years old, and you'd take that thing out. Is that?
Well, yeah, no, I usually took a friend or two along.
Right. But you were basically kids unsupervised. I mean, you had the freedom to go out in the bay. What was that like to go out as a kid and just kind of point that boat wherever you wanted it to go and go?
Well, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun and probably did some dumb things. I mean, we'd take this little boat out to, you know, the Gulf Stream and the Atlantic and, you know, in the shipping lanes and watch these big boats go by if the weather was proper. But I don't think that's unusual for kids that grew up down here. I think I have a lot of friends that did the same sort of things. I mean, you see that now as well in the intercoastal, but you know, my boat was 14 feet long and I think had a 50 horsepower motor. And now everybody seems to have 30-foot boats with triple motors and 400 horsepower on it or something like that. So it was, you know, it was just something we did.
You take a 14-foot boat out to the Gulf Stream?
Yeah, if the weather wasn't right.
Whoa.
Look, there are stories of people that would take their 17-foot boats across to Bimini way back when. This was before GPS and everything else. But was it the smartest thing in the world? No, but I mean, you know, we had compasses and most of the time, you know, you could see the islands and things like that. I mean, it wasn't foolhardy or anything like that, but there was just, there was a lot more, you know, the fish were larger and there were more lobster and a lot of things were easier. There just wasn't, the pressure on the resources that there is now.
I also went on the bay when I was younger, not as often. I never owned a boat, but I had an uncle who did. We went out of the bay a few times, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember certain parts of the bay being clearer water. I mean, the water was more clear most of the year and you could see through that water a lot of the time. I've gone out there more recently and that clarity seems to be, sometimes it's there, but a lot of times there's just not the same clarity that the bay used to have. Is that part of the problem that's going on in Biscayne Bay?
Well, you know, it depends on where you are. I will tell you that my Biscayne Bay basically was from the Stiltsville, Key Biscayne area south. And so those areas still remain some of the clearer and cleaner areas of the bay because there's more circulation there. But to the north, like Dumfounding Bay and places like that, there were some very severe pollution problems back, I think, in the 70s or 80s that actually improved. Miami-Dade County took a lot of measures to clean up that northern section and central section of the bay, and it worked. I think, but I'm not as familiar with that, but I think there is a sense that those areas are now, that those are the areas that are now in decline. Between Miami Beach and the mainland.
Okay, so between Miami Beach and the mainland, so north of Key Biscayne, going up to like the Aventura area?
Yeah, on up through Haulover and that area. Those are areas, I think, where you're seeing the regime change. I will say, however, that even, you know, all the way south in the bay, there's been some University of Miami biologists and scientists over the years who have studied the bay bottom. And near shore, and particularly where there's any kind of inlet or river coming out to the bay, there's also been a die-off of some of the healthier sea grasses, and they've been replaced by other algae and other bottom life that don't support as much marine life. So I think when that happens, weather, wind, and currents can stir up more muck and mud. So there may be days where the bay doesn't look as clear as it once did, because all this stuff can be more easily stirred up. But then other days it'll look exactly like it used to. I mean, I've noticed, I also fish a lot in the Everglades, and Florida Bay has had some very well documented, well chronicled, we wrote about it, seagrass die-offs over the decades, periodic. There was some huge ones in the 80s. And that was an area where the water once was clear almost all the time. And now you go down there, and if the wind kicks up for a couple of days, it's like you're boating on Yoo-Hoo, because there's so much mud in the water. When the wind's tied down, it'll clear up somewhat, but there's been a profound change in the water clarity in Florida Bay, in areas, particularly around Flamingo, that I don't notice quite as much in Biscayne Bay.
Yeah, Flamingo seems to be kind of like kind of a muddy bottom bay. It was not always like that. You're saying it used to be?
Not always, no. And in fact, if you go out there in the summertime, when the winds aren't howling, I think you'll see that right off the, you know, the main little channel there where the hotel used to be, there's a lovely little grass flat. It's not turtle grass that you'd find in the Keys or anything like that, but there are various other sort of grasses there. But that can be clear. You could see fish and redfish and tarpon and things like that from time to time. But this is not a scientific analysis. This is just, hey, my impression of the place where the water clarity has really changed is more that Florida Bay along the coast.
I remember reading that in the 70s and 80s, Tampa Bay was really polluted. And there was an effort done by local and state government officials there to rehabilitate Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, fast forward 30 years and Tampa Bay is in pretty healthy shape today, much healthier than it was 30 or 40 years ago, at least according to what I've read. Is there a possibility to rescue at least the northern part of Biscayne Bay and Florida Bay, and what would it take?
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, I think the there's all sorts of steps that can be done. I mean, the main thing for Florida Bay, I think, is to begin to restore the historic water flow from the Everglades down to the bay. That will lower salinity levels. Theoretically, it would reduce the number of algae blooms and other things that begin to spark these seagrass die-offs. And if you could have, and again, I'm not a scientist, I've just talked to them, but my impression is if you can begin to get the water balanced correctly, then the benthic, the bottom life will slowly recover as well. And I think there's been some evidence more recently. We just, the Water Management District just put out some good news about water levels in the Everglades system and the fact that wading birds had responded and there's a lot of nesting and things like that. And there was some evidence that more water was getting to Florida Bay, which would hopefully reduce some of these things that have knocked down the seagrass beds and other things like that. So I think there are measures that you can take in restoring water flow, in reducing nutrient loads, fertilizers, human and dog crap. You know, I think all these systems can tolerate some of that, again, because dilution is the solution. But I believe that the problems in the central and northern part of Biscayne Bay may have to do with the fact that they don't have quite as much current or quite as much circulation as the southern half does. But that's just my impression. But I think up in the Indian River Lagoon and Brevard and Indian River counties, they've had some very serious pollution problems up there. And I think there's been a big manatee die-off in that area this year, in part because of the damage to the seagrass beds. And there's some thought that these sea cows just might be starving. So that's an area that also has some circulation challenges. It, you know, there's not like a real simple natural flushing system. So I think when those areas experience problems and excess pollution, they're probably more sensitive.
What does Biscayne Bay mean to Miami in terms of its identity? And is it something that everybody can access no matter if they're rich or poor? Tell me about how Biscayne Bay is associated with Miami's identity.
Well, I mean, we've written a couple of stories over the years. It's hard to define it. You know, there's a national park, Biscayne National Park, that covers a lot of Biscayne Bay, again, basically from Stiltsville south to Card Sound Bridge. And most people don't even know they're in it. You know, there's a little headquarters down there in Homestead, but 90% of the park is water. So, I mean, I think historically, people who have been in Miami and love the outdoors in Miami have identified Biscayne Bay as, you know, this gorgeous resource. It's a backyard playground for a lot of people. It's just a lovely landscape, but it's also this, you know, really terrific natural resource full of fish and everything else. So it serves many purposes. But I think the fact that there was a drive by local residents and there was a big push in the 60s to create this national park. Lloyd Miller, excuse me, and former Herald reporter Juanita Green, who was the one of the first environmental reporters in the state of Florida, they campaigned to preserve the bay. I don't know if you remember this, but there was at one point where Turkey Point is now, there was a plan to put a giant oil refinery in the 1950s and dig a giant canal through the middle of the bay. There were plans to develop Elliott Key, yes, and other things into new Miami beaches. And all those efforts to develop those fairly pristine islands and coastal wetlands were met with a great deal of resistance from people who just appreciated the natural beauty and opportunities that were right there on our doorstep. And so there was a lot of passion for the natural bay in this community. I think it exists now, but because it's preserved, it's a little bit different. I mean, you ever been out on lobster season, Oscar? You ever, yes, been out on lobster opening day?
Regrettably, yes. It's not something I want to do again. I've done it a couple times and I'm good.
Many season. Right. Yeah. I used to be a regular and it got to the point where it became so insane, but all those people love the bay. Okay.
Miami is it's an immigrant community. There's a lot of new people coming in every year and every decade. It's kind of a big population churn and the population continues to grow. How much of a challenge is it to get the word out to people who have recently moved here about the importance of Biscayne Bay and the importance of protecting it and, you know, to kind of get them to care?
I know. I guess it's a big challenge. I mean, I think there are probably some people who've lived here for a long time who also don't care. You get people popped for violating, for basically poaching undersized lobster and undersized fish. And sometimes they've recently arrived here and they don't understand the language of the rules. Other times they've been here a long time and it's kind of a side gig, or they've just driven down from Alabama. So, enforcing wildlife regulations, I think, is difficult everywhere, no matter what the makeup of the community is. I think part of it is in Biscayne Bay, there's just so much pressure because there are so many places you can access it. There's boat ramps up and down the county. I mean, there's a bunch of places to put in, and there's relatively little enforcement. The staff at Biscayne National Park, although I haven't checked up on this in probably more than a decade, they had very few patrol boats. They didn't have a lot of people out there policing things and enforcing things. So I think, and a lot of their focus in the last few years has been more about, you know, breaking up parties on flats, than checking boats for undersized lobster and things like that. So there's all sorts of challenges. I think part of it is just, do we devote enough resources to patrols and education? And we probably don't.
Well, I mean, just the fact that the Columbus Day Regatta is on Biscayne Bay, down in Biscayne National Park. I mean, that, talk about a party, on a floating party out there. That I have done a few times, and it's, on the good side, it gets people out there and it gets them swimming in the bay and it makes them love the water. I guess the flip side is maybe it's a little bit over the top, a lot of boats out there, but I think that the more people who get out in the water and appreciate it, I think it builds a community of support for the park. But what do you think?
Well, again, I'm not sure how many of them know they're in the park, which is one of the problems. I mean, look, I mean, the pandemic has also, I think, renewed appreciation for the Bay. I mean, Linda Robertson, one of our reporters, has done a piece about how now there's so many people out on jet skis that they're having conflicts with people who want a kayak and other boaters. So I think there's an appreciation. I don't know if people... There's a certain contingent that uses Biscayne Bay that only cares about the surface. You know, where can I anchor my boat and have a party? Where can I jet ski? But then there's a smaller group that also cares about what's going on under the surface in terms of the health of the resource and the fish and everything else like that. But I haven't seen any surveys, but I think most people who live here appreciate the Bay in one way or another. I mean, it's right there on our, again, it's what we see when we're driving down the road, and it's a backdrop, and I just love it. And I think Miami-Dade's done a pretty good job over the decades of protecting it, but in the last decade, the explosion of growth and everything that we've had, and maybe there's been some sort of tipping point that's been reached in sections of the Bay. And the fact that the county has at least acknowledged it, you know, they appointed a Biscayne Bay czar, somebody who's supposed to, Irela Bagué, who's supposed to kind of oversee and advocate for programs to assist the Bay, is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know yet if it has made a difference or is going to make a difference, but it certainly is not going to hurt.
You know, you mentioned earlier that Biscayne National Park it's a huge national park that's 90% water, and it's kind of the sandwich end of, it's the other end of Everglades National Park. And Miami is the only urban community in the United States that is sandwiched between two national parks. And I think that Miami has the potential to be a radically environmentally conscious community because we have these national parks and because we're surrounded by them. And people fought these battles decades ago to preserve these places. Do you think that Miami's environmental spirit is on the rise, their environmentalist attitude? And how can we foster that? How can we make people care more?
You know, I honestly, Oscar, I don't know how to gauge that. I recall surveys from time to time where they would ask locals if they've been to the Everglades or Everglades National Park. And there was a shockingly high percentage of people who'd never, quote, visited the park. And when you look at, and again, this was a decade ago, I haven't looked at any of these statistics, but when you looked at park visitors, a huge number of them were from out of the state or even out of the country. So I don't know how much appreciation there is for these parks. I think the people who do use them and love them are very, very passionate about it. It's almost like being a Florida Panthers hockey fan. You know, there's a small number of them, but they really love it. But I agree with you that there's all sorts of potential to develop it. I think if you go down to the Keys, because they are they're completely surrounded by water, and most of their tourism is built not on clubs and parties, but on you know, fishing and diving, that the Keys has done a very good job of fostering that kind of awareness and appreciation. And I think some of it drifts up to Miami. But I mean, you know, I think when people think of Miami from around the country, maybe even locally, I mean, they're thinking more of, again, South Beach and not South Biscayne Bay.
And looking to the future, what...
It's your job to foster the support, Oscar.
Well, maybe people will be listening and they'll want to take an interest.
Okay.
But looking toward the future, Curtis, what are we looking out for in terms of policy and issues that are going to affect the Biscayne Bay area? What do we look out for? What's the government plotting? What are developers planning? What's on the horizon for the Bay?
I think the appointment of this Biscayne Bay chief and the fact that they've thrown a little bit of money towards studying what to do is a positive. So I think that the main things are going to be efforts to take out the worst septic tanks. There is a bill right now before the legislature, I might have mentioned this, to support the construction of this sewage treatment plant for Florida Power and Light. If that goes through, the county would be able to divert some of that stuff that they pump offshore. They wouldn't be pumping as much of that. But I don't know exactly what's going to emerge. I think that they're going to identify the nutrients, the source of nutrients, and the biggest problems of pollution for Biscayne Bay, and figure out how to reduce those. That's about the best thing you can do. There's the park has also instituted some different rules for the size and number of fish that you can catch in an effort to restore the fish population. Some of the most popular fish that we all like, little snapper and grouper and yellowtail and things like that, have been really decimated in part from pollution, but more just from fishing pressure. So there's been some effort to kind of reduce the number and size of the takes in an effort to kind of begin to revive those populations. And I think over the years, they've been talk of no fishing zones, which are used throughout the Florida Keys. They've got some areas like around Molasses Reef and some of the better reef areas where you are not allowed to catch, spear, or take any fish. And the theory is there that if those populations begin to recover, that fish will begin to disperse into broader areas. So there's been talk of that, but it hasn't yet happened in Biscayne Bay. There's been some political resistance to that.
So Curtis, what's your call to action? Tell people to get out in the bay. What would you tell people, even people who may not have means to buy a boat or you know, what would you tell people?
Well, Oscar, my call to action is they should stay at home and leave the bay to me. It's already too crowded.
Spoken like a true fisherman.
Okay.
All right. Well, Curtis, this was a great conversation. Thanks for joining me today for the Nature of Florida podcast.
Okay. It's an honor, and my reporters are always available to you. Thanks.
This episode of the Nature of Florida podcast was brought to you in part by the Everglades Foundation, the Felburn Foundation, the Fish and Wildlife Foundation of Florida, and Explica Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to subscribe on our website, thenatureofflorida.buzzsprout.com. That's thenatureofflorida.buzzsprout.com, or find us on your favorite platform and follow us on Facebook and Instagram.